Beginning of time, man has always been impressed with power. Many in our day are continuing to seek some kind of advantage in order to gain an advantage over others, that they might be able to have controlling power over another person or a group of people. What do you think about when you hear the word power? Well, defined, the word means the ability to do or to act, to exercise authority over. The President of the United States has power, yet it is controlled by the Senate and the House and the judicial branch. Nuclear weapons, they have awesome power, but they also must be controlled, and so they won't destroy the whole human race. Power, as we understand it, is the ability to seek control over others. But there is a power that is in existence that there is no control over, no ability to be able to limit the parameters of this power, and nothing of authority or ability that can match the power of God. There is nothing in this world which has ever been, will ever be, or whether ever will be, that will be able to equal or stand in comparison to the power of God. This is the greatest of power that exists today, past, present, or future. How could this fact be proven? Well, in any fact that you try to prove, you've got to have evidence. You can make a claim, but unless the claim has some merit behind it, unless it has some evidence behind it, the claim is hollow. How would one show the power of God is the greatest power that this world has ever known? How would you prove that? On what basis could you reach that conclusion? Well, I believe that there are grounds for belief and that tend to prove that this indeed is a true statement, that the power of God is without equal. To do that tonight, I want to talk for a few minutes about the power of God in evidence. I'd like to begin tonight by reading a passage of Scripture with you from the book of Job. In Job chapter number 26, we want to look, first of all, at verse number 14. Job chapter 26 and verse number 14. Indeed, these are mere edges of his ways. And how shall a whisper, we hear of him? But the thunder of his power, who can understand? Who can understand, really, and how can we understand with our limited ability of knowledge? How can we understand truly and really appreciate the power of God? And so tonight, for a few moments, I want to talk about some power that is in evidence, power that God has given in evidence to demonstrate that his power is something that man needs to reckon with, something that man needs to consider, and something that man needs to be aware of, that he might not be on the other side of that power on the day of judgment. I would begin with showing the power of God in evidence by going, first of all, to creation. In Genesis chapter 1, and you know, we read these passages many times, but sometimes I believe we do not get the full import of what the Scripture says. Turn over to Genesis 1 for just a minute. And Genesis 1:1 is probably one of the most familiar passages in the whole Bible, but yet, listen to what it says. In Genesis 1:1, the text says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And then God said, let there be light, and there was light. There has never been a power that could create simply by stating it to be so. God brought this whole thing that we call the world, everything that's created in it, every living thing that was created, every plant, every animal, every solar system, sun, moon, and stars, light, day, darkness, and night. God spoke this world into existence. You know, man's created a lot of wonderful things. And man has done a lot of wonderful things with his hands. But he's never been able to speak something into existence. God not only spoke the world into existence, he created it with such order that it cries that there is intelligent design behind it. That it could have not just happened. It could have not just come together as we know it today. It cries that there is intelligent design. In Psalms chapter 19 and verse number 1, the psalmist wrote these words, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard." You cannot look at anything in the world and not be impressed by the majesty, the power, and the design and the order of creation. In the Hebrew letter, in chapter number 11 and verse number 3, the Hebrew writer wrote, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things that are seen were not made of things which are invisible." In Romans chapter 1 and verse number 20, it says that creation leaves man without excuse. If I had to give my first evidence that the power of God indeed is real and it is something that man needs to consider, I would show the creation, because the creation is God's exhibit A, that his power is greater than any that man will ever know. And last of all about the creation, I would go no further than the greatest of his creation, and that is mankind. Mankind is one of the most difficult human beings and one of the most difficult parts of God's creation for us to understand. The body is a magnificent thing. It takes care of itself in so many different ways. I've heard lectures from people that are much more apt in that area than I am to show that, you know, the little things. Let me give you an example. When you have something foreign that enters your body, what happens is that when something foreign enters our body, there are things that come to pass that will attack that, whatever that is, that virus or whatever it might be, and it will attack it until it drives it out because it's foreign to the body and the body has a mechanism that tells it that it's dangerous. Now what happens once those things come together and attack that virus and drive it out? What happens to those things? It's stored in a memory bank. And in that memory bank that is stored, that if that ever invades your body again, that thing will automatically attack it until it drives it out. Do you know that you have millions of these things in your memory bank? How did that just happen? How did that just take place over a period of time? Brethren, the Bible clearly says that God created man from the dust of the earth. And he created something that is just, we are still learning about the human body. We are still learning about how wonderful and magnificent it has been made. It demonstrates that there is a God, and his power is more than any man can reckon with. But if I had to look at another thing to demonstrate the power of God in evidence, I would go to the flood. Take your Bibles and turn to Genesis chapter 6. In Genesis chapter 6, we see the account here when God looked down upon the earth and he saw that their heart was evil continually. And in Genesis chapter 6, beginning at about verse 4, it says, "And there were giants in the earth in those days. And also afterwards the Son of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. They were mighty men of, and were old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of his thought of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was so grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I made them." And you continue reading the flood account in the book of Genesis, chapter 7, chapter 8, and chapter 9. He gave some instruction to a man called Noah. Noah, who found grace in the eyes of the Lord, according to verse 8. And this man was given some detailed instructions in the building of what we refer to as the ark. And the ark was made out of gopher wood, and it was three stories. It had pitch inside and out. It had things that God told him to put in it. And in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 22, it says, as God commanded, thus did Noah, according to all that God commanded, so did he. And then God brought the rain upon the earth. Now, it wasn't just rain. Now, we've seen floods, and we've seen times when rain seems that it's never going to stop. It might leave 3 or 4 inches on the ground, but that's not what we're talking about when we talk about the flood. When we talk about the flood, we're talking about the heavens being open and the waters underneath the earth, the dams being open, and the water coming not only from above, but from underneath. And the water was so high that it covered the highest mountain. It took over 360 days, that's about 370 days that Noah was in the ark. It took the water over 180 days to dissipate after they stopped raining after 40 days and 40 nights. And during all of this time, God destroyed everything that he himself had created except the 8 souls and the animals that were taken in the ark. You know what that tells me? He created it. He can destroy it. He has the power not only to create, he also has the power to destroy. And yet there are many people today that do not believe in God and all of his love and his mercy and all of his long-suffering and his patience and his love for mankind, that he will ever destroy that which he created. I would submit to you tonight that he already did it once. He did it in Genesis chapter 6. And if you read, he caused it to rain for 40 days and 40 nights, and everything that drew the breath of life that was upon the earth that was not in the ark, it died. The same God that had the power to speak it into creation had the ability to destroy it at his own choosing according to his own pattern. But you know what? God left evidence what he did because he made a promise. In Genesis chapter 9, he put a rainbow in the sky. And this rainbow was a covenant. A covenant that God made with Noah and he really made with us. That he promised that he would never destroy the world again by water. He didn't say that he'd never destroy it again. He said he'd never destroy it by water. And whenever you see a rainbow, it's a beautiful thing. After a real heavy rain, you look in the sky and you see that rainbow. That's the evidence of the power of God. That rainbow is there because God put it there. It's there to remind man of what God did and the promise that man made. It is the evidence of God, and it shows his power. Ask somebody to explain to you why we have a rainbow. You ever been in a science class and let them explain it to you? When they're done, you're going to be wondering what you heard, but I know why that rainbow's there. It's because God put it there. God put it there as a reminder of his awesome power. But if I wonder also about the power of God, I think about the birth of Isaac. In Genesis chapter 12, there was a man named Abraham. And Abraham was a man who was a very faithful follower of God in the patriarch age. And this man, God made 3 promises to. He said that he was going to make him a mighty nation. He said he was going to give that nation a land. And through his seed, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. At that time, Abram was 70 years old, almost 75 years old, and he did not have a son. And so, in a period of time, God said that he was going to return the time of life to Abraham and that he would indeed have a son. In Genesis, the 15th chapter, and in verse number 4, Genesis 15, verse 4, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, this one shall not be your heir, but the one who will come from your own body shall be your heir. Then he brought him outside and said, look now towards heaven. Count the stars if you are able to number them. And he said to them, so shall your descendants be. And he believed the Lord, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. At this time, he's talking about Ishmael. Ishmael was somebody that Hagar decided that she'd give, or Sarah decided that she'd help God out in Genesis 16, and she gave her handmaiden Hagar to wife to Abraham. At that time, he was 86, because she was still without a child, and so she was going to help God out in this promise. And indeed, a child was born. His name was Ishmael. But God said, he's not the child of promise. That is not the one that I promised you, that you're going to have one that you're going to be the father, father, and Sarah is going to be the mother. And when he made that promise to Abraham and he renewed it, Abraham was 86 years old, and it would take 14 more years before that promise was ever given and fulfilled. But you know, in Genesis chapter 18, there's a very important statement made. And I believe it's a principle that we'd be well to remember. In Genesis chapter 18 and verse 14, it says, "Is there anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." Now, brethren, when Isaac was born, Abraham was 100 years old. Sarah was 90. And it happened a year from the time that God told Abraham, "This time next year, you will have a son." Now, in Hebrews chapter 11, it tells us why Abraham had such faith. In Hebrews 11 and verse 17, it says, "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered his only begotten son, of whom it was said, 'And Isaac, your seed shall be called,' according that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense." In other words, Abraham's body was dead at 100 years old, but yet God was able, with his power, to raise up seed, that he was able to have a son. And if God could do that, if Isaac's life was taken on that altar, God would raise him up. Why? Because he had the power. God had the power, and Abraham didn't doubt the power of God. Even if he was called to take Isaac's life, he knew by the birth of Isaac that God's power could put life back in him, because it was through Isaac that the seed was going to continue. Brethren, that's power. That's power that man does not understand. That's why Abraham believed. That's why he had faith. That's why he's called the father of faith. That's why he's the father of the Israelite nation. Here's a man that believed it simply because God said it. Somebody told you, if you were past the age of childbearing, and let's say you were 70 or 80 years old, and said, "Now in 20 years from this day, you're going to have a son, and your wife is going to be his mother, and you shall call his name Isaac." You would know that that man is not thinking in his right mind. But you know, Abraham said he believed God, and it was a count. Why did he believe God? Because he believed in the power of God. He believed there was nothing too hard for the Lord. And then I think about something else that shows a subject that I hope to do some lessons on in the future, and that's providence. And when you think about God's providence, there's one person that has to come to your mind. It's a man named Joseph. Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Not only was he one of the 12 sons, he was one of the youngest sons. His brother Benjamin, I believe, was the youngest. But Joseph was a favored son. He was a son that Jacob loved, because he was a child of his old age, and he also, who was his mother? Rachel. Rachel was his mother, a woman that he loved more than he loved Leah. But anyway, through the period of time, Joseph is given some ability. And one of the abilities that Joseph is given is the ability to dream dreams. And not only dream dreams, but he's able to interpret them. And so he has this dream that one day he saw his father and his brothers bowing down and worshiping him. Remember the sheaves in the field, and they were all bowing down and paying homage to Joseph. Remember what his brothers did? They didn't like that. They thought he was a little bit arrogant. And so one day the father sends him out to the field and says, "Go and check on your brothers." And he goes out there, and they say, "Here comes his dream. Let's get rid of him. Let's kill him," in Genesis 37. "Let's kill him, and we'll see what happens to his dreams." And so Reuben talks him out of it. Reuben talks him out of it, and they throw him in a pit. And while he is gone, a band of Ishmaelites come by, and they sell him to the Ishmaelites and sell him into slavery. They take his coat, dip it in the goat's blood, send it back to his father, and let his father believe for a number of years that his son is dead and has been devoured by a wild beast. What happened to Joseph? Joseph didn't stay with the Ishmaelites. Joseph, in Genesis 39, is sold to a man named Potiphar in Egypt. And while in Potiphar's household, Potiphar notices that everything he gives and he places in the hands of Joseph to take care of, he sees that it prospers. And so he makes him second in control of his own home. And he makes him to be a very powerful man in Egypt. But you know, Joseph was growing and he was maturing, and he's a very good-looking young man. And Potiphar's wife began to look at him in a different way and tried to seduce him. But if you go back to Genesis chapter 39, you know what Joseph said in verse 9? He said, I cannot sin against God, and I cannot sin against my master. He has placed everything in my control except you, because you are his wife. She wasn't to be denied. She tried to force him to lie with her. He ran out, and because she was discouraged because he did not give in to her desires, she told her husband that he had forced himself on her. What did the husband do? Well, he did what any good husband would do. He threw him in jail. No questions, no trial, just threw him in jail. And he was there for a number of years. But you know, what did Joseph do while he was in jail? He pined away, pouted. Did he bemoan the fact that he's in there, didn't do anything, and yet I'm trying to serve God, and look where I'm at? No, he didn't do that. You know what he did? He did well while he was in prison. And the prisoners, one of the guards of the prisoners saw that when he gave Joseph responsibility over the other prisoners, that everything went well. And so he put all the other prisoners in charge by Joseph. And he did well. But while he was in prison, there was also two men thrown in of the household of Pharaoh, a baker and a butler. And during the night, these two men had two dreams. And they were really troubled by these dreams. And so they wanted to know what the meaning of these dreams were. And so David told him that the butler, he'd be returned to his position of prominence in 3 days. But the baker, in that same 3-day period, he'd be taken out and hung, and the birds will eat his flesh. Now, one dream has a pretty good ending. The other one doesn't. But you know what? In 3 days, it happened just like he said it. What did he ask? What did Joseph ask in return for him interpreting your dreams? What did he ask? When you go to the king, don't forget about me. Did he forget? Yeah, he forgot for 2 years. Did he gripe? Did he complain? Did he just wallow in self-pity in prison for 2 more years? No. He fulfilled his duties in an honorable manner. And in the passage of time, the king has a dream. And the king calls all of his magicians and his counselors and all of his men of great renown together, and he wants them to interpret this dream that he's had. None of them can do it, so he's going to kill him. He's going to kill him because nobody can tell him the meaning of this dream. And you know what? The butler remembered. The butler said, today I remember my fault. There's a man in prison. And he told Pharaoh about what happened with the butler and the baker. And so he called for Joseph, brought him up, cleaned him up, stood him before himself and said, I hear you can tell the interpretation of dreams. You know, the thing that's remarkable about Joseph, he didn't take credit for that. He says, no, I don't have the ability, but God can give you the interpretation. Tell me the dream and I'll tell God will give you the interpretation. And you know the dream about the 7 lean cows, the 7 fat cows, 7 years of famine, 7 years of plenty. And after he told him the dream, he said, you know, I need to put somebody in charge. He says, what should I do? He said, well, I'll tell you what you should do. You should take the 7 years of plenty, and you should take a little bit, and you ought to store it up in storehouses, and you ought to keep it when the 7 years of famine come, so you not only can feed Egypt, but you can feed the world, and everybody will have to come to Egypt in order to gain food. That's what you ought to do. And you know, Pharaoh thought that was a great thing. He says, I need an honorable man to do that. Who should I get? He says, he's standing right before me. He put Joseph in charge of that. And Joseph was second in command of all of Egypt. Do you remember the dream where his brothers and his father are paying homage to him? Lo and behold, what happens in Canaan? Famine. They need food. Where do they got to go? They got to go to Egypt. Who do they got to see? They got to see Joseph. And remember, they bowed down to Joseph when they came to get the grain. They didn't recognize Joseph, but Joseph recognized them. And you know how the story is, that he finagled some way to get his younger brother back down there by keeping one of them. And then I want you to turn to Genesis 50. Now you think of what Joseph could have done. You think of what Joseph could have did and done in the position that he was in. He could have got revenge and it would have been easy and nobody would have blamed him. And now Israel died. Now they're in Egypt. They've been there for about 17 years. And Israel dies. And now the brothers believe that Joseph is going to enact punishment against them. But I want you to notice in Genesis 50, and I want you to notice verse number 19. Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive." You see, Joseph said, "I'm not God. It's not up to me. I'm not God. God made these provisions that allowed me to be in this position that I could save my people." You know, he did. How do you think they grew into the nation of Israel? How do you think they ever got into Egypt? How did they ever grow to the nation that God said that they would be back in Genesis 12? 70 souls went into Egypt. In Exodus, those 70 souls turned into 3 million people. How'd that happen? Power of God caused that to happen. Power of God caused that to happen. What would you consider the greatest miracle in the Bible? Healing the blind man? Well, that was a pretty remarkable thing. But one of the greatest Bible miracles is the parting of the Red Sea. In Exodus chapter 14, they had just got out of Egypt. They had witnessed with their own eyes the 10 plagues that God brought upon Egypt. What he basically did is he brought Pharaoh to his knees. And he demonstrated his power not only to Egypt, but for all the world to see and for the children of Israel to see, because in the land of Goshen where they were living, where Israel moved with his family, in the land of Goshen, the plagues were all around them, but they did not affect them. Remember the darkness was over the face. Let me just give you one example. You remember when the darkness was over the whole earth and they couldn't even see in their home? But there was light in the little city of Goshen. And what was that to do? That was to demonstrate God's power. That was to show that Pharaoh, he thought, "Who is the Lord? I don't know God, and neither will I obey, and neither will I let Israel go. I don't know who the Lord is. I'm not going to show any respect for him." Well, God introduced himself to Pharaoh. And he demonstrated with great power that he was God to be reckoned with. And you remember the magicians, they got it really quick. They said, "Why don't you let him go? He's destroying Egypt. Look all around you. Egypt is being destroyed. Get this man out." But Pharaoh was stubborn. He wouldn't do it. Finally, with the death of the firstborn, he relented. And remember, all these people had seen those 10 plagues. They get to the Red Sea in Exodus 14. And there is a pillar of fire, a cloud, that is leading them. There is a pillar of fire behind them. And it is a keeping at bay the Egyptians who are hot in pursuit of them. Now think about it for a minute. Here you have just witnessed these 10 terrible plagues in Egypt. You have seen God's power demonstrated by keeping you safe and the plagues he brought on Egypt. They get to the Red Sea and they are afraid. They are afraid and they begin to murmur and they begin to complain and they begin to want to go back to Egypt. You know, they're lucky they're dealing with God and they're not dealing with someone like me. Because had I been God, I would have sent them back. I would have said, "You want back, you'll go back." But he didn't do that. He didn't do that, but what he did was one of the greatest Bible miracles. And you know, I think sometimes we watch the movies too much and we think this is like the Ten Commandments and Charlton Heston parting the Red Sea. But it's a little bit more remarkable than that. He caused an east wind to blow all night long. And while the wind blew, the waters parted. And they parted with a wall of water on the right, a wall of water on the left, and there was dry ground in the middle, and they were going to march across to the other side. You know, I've read some little bit of secular history and a little bit of Josephus, and there is some evidence that there could have been up to 1.5 to 2 million Jews. And when they marched across the breadth of the Red Sea, they could have been in a single file. Now you think about how long that would be. Now you think about how long. I read one thing, it was maybe a 3-mile stretch. A 3-mile stretch, completely dry ground, and a wall of water on the left and the right. Now, before you step one foot out there, what do you know in your mind? You know that whatever power divided those waters has the ability to bring them back again. Wouldn't you know that? If those waters are parted and you can see the water, you know, I've always wondered if they could see any fish there. On the wall there, I've always wondered about that. I don't know. I think I'm going to ask if I'm lucky enough to get to heaven. I'm going to ask. But you see, what would you have in order to go out there? You'd have to have faith. You'd have to have faith in God that His power will keep those waters at bay, that they won't bring them back. And you know they did. And they went across. But you know, the tragedy of this whole thing is the Egyptians, after what they went through in Egypt, they kind of had a brain loss for a minute. They ran in after them. Now, what do you and I know? We know what we already just said. We know whoever brought those waters apart has the ability to bring them back together again. And when the Egyptians got out there in the middle, the mud began to cling to their wheels. And you know, if the mud clung to their wheels, why didn't it bother the Israelites? Why did they get stuck? You wonder about that? Why did they get stuck? But you know what happened? The light went on. And the Egyptians said, God is fighting for them. We cannot defeat them. And they began to whine. You know what? Even in the movies, this is pretty impressive. When they're running and the walls are collapsing, they're coming together again. And when they look on the other side, what do they see? The Egyptians lying dead on the seashore. Do you believe in the power of God if you witness that? They did, but you know what? They didn't think about it too long. You know what they did in Exodus 16? They didn't have any water and food, and they began to murmur against God. And they began to say they wanted to go back to Egypt. Here we go again. What had they just saw? What did they just see with their eyes, their physical salvation? What made it possible? The power of God. Next time somebody tells you that you don't believe in miracles, you remind them about the Red Sea. And I don't believe it because I saw it in a movie. I believe it because the Bible said it so. That was a miracle. That showed the power of God. Let me give you another thing to think about. What about the taking of the city of Jericho? You know, secular history tells us that there were two walls surrounding Jericho, an outer wall and an inner wall. And they may have been up to 3 inches thick of stone or rock. And you know why they built these great fences and walls? In biblical times, they were for defense. You put these high towers up on above the wall, and you could look all around, and no enemy could get you. He could penetrate you because you would be able to see them no matter which way they came. You'd be able to see them, and you'd be able to prepare. And so when they go into the land of conquest, the first battle is Jericho. I want you to turn to Joshua chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. I want you to notice the language that is used. You know, Brother Sellers brought this out a couple of classes ago, and sometimes we overlook little words that can have a lot of meaning to a passage. I want you to look at something in Genesis, in Joshua 6. It says, now Jericho was securely shut up because the children of Israel, none went in, none went out. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I have given Jericho into your hand, and his king and the mighty men of valor. Now I ask you something. What does it say there? I have given. What does that mean? It means it's yours. They're still not in. They haven't done anything. And God said, I have given it to you. What does that tell you? It's a fact. It's going to happen. It's a done deal. It's going to happen. I'm going to give it to you. That's emphatic. It's not something that might happen. It's not something that could happen. This is going to happen, and God's going to deliver it. All right, how's he going to do it? And you shall march around the city, all the men of war. You shall go around it, the city once. This you shall do for 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear the 7 trumpets of the ram's horn before the ark. But the 7th day you shall march around the city Seven times the priest shall blow the trumpet, and it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, that all the people shall shout with a great shout, then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go in every man straightway. I've been in the military. I know all about battle plans. I know about strategy. I know about making plans of war. What do you think in 1991 when we went into the Persian Gulf and we were going to try to take the city of Kuwait, that we came up, that Norman Schwarzkopf came up with a plan like this? They would have carted them away in the funny farm. Why did God make this plan so simple? Because there's only one way that it works. That's if God's power is behind it. Marching around those walls, we're going to bring them walls down. Blowing the trump of the ram's horn, not going to bring those walls down. The thing that brought the walls down, Hebrews 11:30 says, by faith the walls of Jericho fell. What is faith? Faith comes by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. When they did exactly what God said, God brought down the walls. And you know what? We know that this miracle happened. You know why? 3 years ago, they found those walls buried under 20 feet of earth. And you know what they couldn't figure out? They couldn't figure out why they were laying down and why they were intact. I know why. Because God brought them down. God didn't say they would crumble down. God said they will fall down. And that's exactly what they did. There was also a cursed place that Jericho could never be rebuilt, and it never has been rebuilt. What does all that demonstrate? It demonstrates that God's power is something to be reckoned with. I want to leave you with one other case in the New Testament. What about the raising of Lazarus? John chapter 11. Turn over to John chapter 11 for a moment. Lazarus, he's been in the grave 4 days. And the tomb has been sealed. And Mary and Martha, when Jesus comes, they're so happy to see him. And both of them say on different occasions, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. What does that demonstrate? That demonstrates that they believe the power that Jesus had. They believe that if Jesus had been there, their brother never would have died because he had the power to do something about his death. But you know what? Jesus still had the power to do something about his death. And in John chapter 11, if you get down at verse number 39. It says, then he said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he's been dead 4 days. You don't want to remove the stone. You want to leave it there. He's been in there 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not say to you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God? Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and now I know you always hear me, but because of the people who are standing by, I say this, that they may believe that you sent me. And when he had said this, he said and cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. You know, for many, many years, I remember preachers telling me that there was a reason why he just called Lazarus. And there was. Because Lazarus was the only one that he wanted to come out of the grave. In John 5, 28 and 29, Jesus himself said, the hour is coming, and now is, when all that are in the grave shall hear my voice. And they shall come forth, those that have done good to the resurrection of life, and those that have done evil to the resurrection of damnation. God's voice will be able to bring the dead to life. That's why he just called Lazarus' name. Now, and he who died came bound, hand and foot, and gravecloths, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. Benny Hinn has never done a miracle like this. And if he ever does, I'll eat my Bible. What would men do today if a man was able to perform the feat that Jesus did right here? I think that makes CNN, don't you? Don't you think that that would get around? If Benny Hinn or one of these great faith healers of our day was able to take a man that was buried in a grave 6 foot out of the ground in a vault and was able to make him say, come forth from the grave, and he'd come out of that vault, I'd be a believer. I'd be a believer. But you know what? They've never done that. I wonder why. Wonder why they've never done that. Because they don't have the power of God. God has the power over life and death. Men don't have that kind of power. And you know what? That kind of power has not been in existence since the end of the first century. The power to bring life to death. But you know what? How effective was this miracle? How effective did it demonstrate Jesus was who he claimed to be? Turn over to John 12. Look at verse 10. But the chief priests took counsel that they might also put Lazarus to death, because on his account, many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. This guy's walking evidence. We got to get rid of him. He's evidence that God's power is real. Now, I want to close with this thought. If God has the power that we've just demonstrated and seen in the scriptures, if God has that kind of power, then I believe there's a couple things that we can know that God has the power to do. And the first one I want to submit to you tonight is God has the power to hear prayer and to answer prayer. If he can part the Red Sea, if he can bring the walls of Jericho down, if he can bring the dead back to life, if he can cause the blind to see, the lame to walk, if he could cause his son to walk in the water, I believe it's not too hard for God to answer me when I call upon him when I have a time of need. Why does the Bible say, cast all your care upon him, for he careth for you? Why does the Bible say in Philippians 4, verse 6, let your request be made known to God? Why does it say in James 5, verse 16, the effectual prayer of a righteous man availeth much? Because there's power in prayer, because it is God who answers. I believe prayer works because God's power is real. I also believe that if God's power is real, he has the ability to forgive my sin and cause me to have the ability to stand before him justified, sanctified, reconciled, and be his child and be able to stand before him in judgment and not on bended knee in fear, but all knowing that God will give me what he's promised. Ephesians 1 verse 7, it says, we have forgiveness of sin, we have forgiveness and redemption by the blood of Jesus Christ. 1 Peter 1, 18 and 19 says, you have been redeemed by the precious blood of the Lamb. Do you believe in the power in the blood? The power in the blood is just as an evidence as the power that he spoke the world into creation. The same power that spoke the world into creation, the same power that raised Lazarus from the grave, the same power that raised that part of the Red Sea, the same power is in the blood because God put it there. And it has the ability to wash away sin and cause you to stand justified before God. You just got to believe it. You just got to believe it and take advantage of it. And one thing I want to leave you with. All the naysayers in our world and in our society and the religious world today that says hell is not a real place and hell does not exist and that God will not cause any of the lost to be condemned to a devil's hell, forget about the power of God. The power of God says that such a place exists. It's a place prepared for the devil and his angels. It's a place of fire and brimstone. It's a place that's called the second death. It's a place that all those who are in Hades and those that die lost will be cast into, according to Revelation 20, verse 11 and 15. And my friend, if you don't believe that God's power, the power that spoke the world into existence, create such a place as hell, then you don't believe in the power of God. The power of God exists. And you know what? People say, well, you fear God, you serve God out of fear, you had better believe it. I believe hell exists because I believe the power of God exists to cast man there if he's disobedient to God. Does God desire that? No. 2 Peter 3, 9 says he desires all men to be saved. But God's power is in evidence that if he says that it's there, it is there. And if it's there, he will do exactly what he said he will do. Brethren,
you have never seen. And you cannot even begin to comprehend the power that our God has. We haven't touched the tip of the iceberg tonight to the power of the God whom we serve and who created this whole world. The God that we serve has the ability to stop this world at his choosing, in his time, according to his will, according to his plan and his design. You see, brethren, we're not in control. We think we're the greatest power on the earth. We're not. How many times have you heard we're the greatest power on earth? How many times have you heard politicians say the greatest power on the earth is the United States? That's a lie. The greatest power in the world is not in the United States. The greatest power in the world is with God. It has always been and will always be. The United States doesn't control this world. The God in heaven controls this world. And when he says it's enough, and when he says time will be no more, it'll stop. It'll stop on time. And there's nothing that you, me, or any nation on this earth, including our own, that will stop. When God says it's over, it's over. And nothing that man does will stop. Now, brethren, that kind of power gets my attention. That kind of power is what I believe in. That kind of power is the God that I serve. And that is the God who has called upon me that I can benefit from that power if I will do one simple thing. If I will love him and I will obey him. Ecclesiastes 12 said, let us hear the conclusion of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. The power of God in heaven. It is real. It exists. And we had better believe it in order for us not to be on the other side of it when he returns. Please take your Bibles out, or excuse me, your psalm books. Turn to the psalm that has been selected. If that power exists, would you take a risk on being on the wrong side of the ledger on the day of judgment? You know, to me, when you read the Bible, and you read about all that God has done,